If we may record. May 4th, 1962, Lecture 44, The Laws of Thermodynamics. May 4th, 1962, Lecture 44, The Laws of Thermodynamics. May 4th, 1962, Lecture 44, The Laws of Thermodynamics.
What happened to the matches? Matches.
Tom left. Is there
anything? I need matches.
Matches.
Yes, I need matches. Have you got matches?
Three.
They have to have something to strike them against. Do any of you guys got a pack of matches, please? Any of you guys got matches? Matches. Okay. Thank you. Okay, fine. All right. So far, we've been discussing the properties of matter from the point of view, from the atomic point of view, trying to understand roughly what will happen if we suppose that things are made out of atoms obeying certain laws. However, there are a number of relationships among the properties of substances which can be worked out without knowing the inner guts of the materials. The subject of determining the relationships of the various properties of materials independent of their without knowing their internal machinery is the subject of thermodynamics, and of course historically came before the understanding of the internal materials, the internal behavior of the objects. To give an example, we know from the kinetic theory that the pressure is due to the bombardment, and if we heat the gas up we get more bombardment, the pressure should increase. On the other hand, for the same reason that pressure is due to bombardment, if we push the piston against which the objects are bombarding, it will give more energy to them. So on the one hand, if we increase the temperature at a given volume, we'll increase the pressure. On the other hand, if we compress the gas a little bit, we'll find that the temperature rises, or that it's heated up, that the temperature rises. And there is, of course, in the kinetic theory, a relation between these two, but kind of instinctively, one might guess that they're sort of related in some necessary fashion, that is independent of the details of the collisions. Let me give another example. Your intuitions may not agree that it's independent, but that means that you might be able to deduce one from the other, but perhaps they do. Let me give another example. I don't know if you know, but many people know, the interesting property of rubber. If you take a rubber band and pull it, it warms. If you put it between your lips, for example, and pull the rubber band out, you can feel a distinct warming. And it's reversible in this sense, that if you relax the rubber band quickly while it's between your lips, it's distinctly cooled. That means that when we stretch a rubber band, it heats, and when we release the tension in the band, it cools. Now, maybe your instincts suggest, and maybe they don't, your intuition suggests, maybe they don't, that therefore, if you heat a band, it'll pull or it'll relax, one or the other. I mean, that there's some kind of connection between the fact that when you pull a band, it heats, and that when you heat a band, it pulls. And first, let me show you that when you heat a band, it pulls. I have here a rubber band that's holding a weight. And I'm going to heat it, not so much that it burns, I hope, but you watch and see if you can't see a slight motion of the weight. You see? So it's true that when we heat a band, it pulls, and it's definitely related to the fact that when we release the pressure on a band, or tension on a band, it cools. Now, the internal machinery of rubber that makes this happen is quite complicated. I'll describe it to you from a molecular point of view to some extent so you can understand it that way. But our main purpose today is to understand the relationship of those two features independently of the molecular model. Nevertheless, I assure you that from the molecular model, they're closely physically related. One way to understand the behavior of rubber is to realize that it consists of enormous tangle of long chains of molecules, like some kind of spaghetti, with one extra complication, that between the chains from here to there, there's links, there's cross links. It's like spaghetti that sort of got welded together every once in a while where it crossed another piece of spaghetti, a grand tangle. When you pull out such a grand tangle, of course, there's more chains going along the direction of pull than there were before. It was every which way. But when you pull it out, there are a lot of chains going along the direction of pull. At the same time, there's thermal energy in the thing. Things are jiggling around. Imagine, if you will, some chains running across this room, more this way. Let's not worry about the cross chain, going across this way. And that there's thermal motion of jiggling the chains. For example, there are other molecules hitting them all the time. Then you see that such a chain, if stretched out, will not by itself remain stretched out all by itself, because it'll be hit from the sides by the jigglings of the other chains and other molecules, and it'll get kinked up. And so the ends will tend to shorten. And so the real reason why rubber bands tend to contract is this, that when you pull them out, the chains are lengthwise, and the thermal agitations of the molecules on the side are tending to kink the chains up and pull them shorter. You can therefore appreciate that if the chain is held out and I increase the temperature, increasing the vigor of the bombardment on the sides of the chains, more is the tendency for them to come down, pull in, and therefore they're able to pull a stronger weight when I heat it up than before. And the opposite, the same chain stretched across with the molecules bombarding it. Suppose that now I let the chain relax. I mean, I'm letting the ends of the rubber come together. Then the chain is sort of soft. As a molecule hits it, it's going the way, it's kinking up the way the molecules would like it to kink up. In other words, they lose energy when they pound into the chain as the chain is shortening in. And so the temperature falls. Now, these two things are related clearly by the kinetic theory, but it would be a terrible challenge to figure out exactly the relationship between the two by the kinetic theory, because you have to know how many collisions per second, what do the chains look like, and all kinds of complications. Nevertheless, in spite of the detailed mechanism, and we can't, by kinetic theory, really figure out what should happen, what either of the two effects are, but the fact that they're both related by a definite relation can be worked out without knowing anything about the internal machinery. And this method of doing this constitutes the subject of thermodynamics. The whole subject depends in its analysis on this. If the strength of a rubber band would be stronger at higher temperatures than it is at lower temperatures, then it ought to be possible, just like you saw me lift a weight, to lift weights and to move them around and do work with heat. And so to studying the way that one does work with heat, that's the beginning of the science of thermodynamics. Can we make an engine by which the heating effect on a rubber band can be used to do work? Well, I have a silly engine here that does that. Here is a wheel in which all the spokes are rubber bands. Now, if I heat the rubber bands on this side, they'll be stronger than the rubber bands on the other side, no? Because, well, you saw that. And so the wheel will have it pulled over to one side. So the center of gravity of the wheel will not be at the bearing, but over here. So the wheel will try to turn. Of course, after it turns, then this new rubber comes in here. The rubber which goes out here cools off, and gradually it's still. So it never, well, believe it or not, the thing sort of works after a fashion. The efficiency of this engine is extremely low. 400 watts of power are being poured into the two lamps. As you can see, it's just about possible to lift a fly with the other end of it. The question does come up, though, as to whether we could not perhaps design a rubber band machine that takes energy out of heat that's more efficient than a steam engine. Although it looks like we've got a long way to go, it's an interesting question. The interesting question is whether we can get heat to do work in more efficient ways. In fact, this is the beginning of the science of thermodynamics, an analysis by the great engineer Carnot of the problem of how to build the best and most efficient engine. Once in a while, engineering has contributed a great deal to theoretical or to physics in general. And two examples that come to mind is the analysis of heat engines by the engineer Carnot, and the other is the analysis of information theory by Shannon recently. And both of those, incidentally, are closely related phenomena, it turns out. Now, in the usual way the steam engine works, of course, is the heat goes in and boils the water, and the water expands and pushes some piston which makes the wheel go around. But you have to finish the job. You could, one stupid way would be let the steam run out into the air, but then you have to keep supplying water. Well, it's cheaper to just let the steam go into another box where it's condensed by cool water, and then the water's pumped back into the boiler and goes around, so. And you get heat out of the engine. Now, would it be better to use alcohol? What properties should a substance have so that it makes the best possible engine? And that was the question that Carnot addressed himself to. And one of the byproducts of this was a discovery of the type of relationship that I explained that we have to find before. Of course, now to discuss then the laws of thermodynamics. At the time when Carnot lived, the first law, the conservation of energy, was not known. Carnot's arguments were so carefully drawn, however, that they are valid even though the first law was not known at his time. People afterwards, Clausius in particular, made a simpler derivation so that people could understand it easier than Carnot's very subtle reasoning. And it turned out that Mr. Clausius used something which was not the conservation of energy, that heat was conserved. Heat that went in was the same amount of heat going in out, according to the caloric theory, which was false. And so it's often been said that Carnot's logic was wrong. It isn't Carnot's logic was all right. It was just the simplified version that everybody read was not right. When the first law of thermodynamics was finally discovered, the conservation of energy is the same as called the first law of thermodynamics. When that was discovered afterwards, the second law of thermodynamics was discovered first by Carnot. The first law of thermodynamics was discovered second. And there's the conservation of energy. It would be a good idea for the fun of it to try to give you Carnot's argument without using the first law. However, I won't do that because you want to learn and not history exactly. So we'll put everything together at the beginning, and I'm going to use the first law all the way through, in spite of the fact that a great deal of the thing can be done without the first law. Now, Carnot noticed this. Was known. Well, I won't say the way Carnot did because he doesn't use the first law, but I'll say it my own way. We know that when we do work, well, first let me state the first law to get that out of the way. That's the conservation of energy. And that law is the following. If you have something, you put heat into it, and you do work on it, then its energy is increased by the heat that you put in and the work that you did. That's the first law. And I've written here that the heat that you put in any object plus the work done on the object is the increase in the energy of that object. That's sometimes called internal energy. And if U is called the energy of the object, then the change in U can be represented as adding a little heat and adding a little work would be the change in the U. That's a differential form of the same thing. But anyway, that one we know very well because we had quite a lecture on that. Now, we also know that if we do work, say, against friction, that work which is lost to us appears as heat. And if we do work in a room at temperature T and do the work slowly enough, the room temperature doesn't change much, and we have converted work into heat at a given temperature. What about the reverse possibility? Is it possible to convert the heat back into work at a given temperature? That would be very nice. We could take, you see, from the point of view of the conservation of energy, all the heat energy, the vibrational motions of the molecules of the water in the sea is an awful lot of energy, and we ought to be able to make use of that. That's a good supply of energy. It turns out, though, Carnot proposed or assumed that it would be impossible to extract the energy of heat away from single temperature. If, in other words, if the whole world were the same temperature, you couldn't get any more work out of the thing. That is, that the process of making work go into heat, that can go one way at a given temperature, but you can't get the heat back out again. To be specific, the assumption is made by Carnot that heat cannot be taken in at a certain temperature and converted into work, and nothing else changed. That's very important, that last phrase, because suppose we have a a can of compressed air at a certain temperature. Then we let the air expand. It can do work, you know, it can make hammers go and all kinds of things. It cools off a little in the expansion, but if we had a big sea like the ocean at a given temperature, we use it as a heat reservoir, we can warm it up again. So we take the heat out of the sea, and we've done work with the compressed air. So it seems like Carnot is warm. But what he meant was to completely leave everything back the way it was. That is, to get that air, which you just let expand, and compress it back into the can again. Then you'll find you're doing a lot of extra work and other heats and so on. And when you're all finished, you'll find out you didn't get more work. You didn't get work out of temperature T. You put it in the net result. In other words, we're talking about a situation in which the net result of the whole business is to take heat away and convert it into work. Just like the net result of the whole business of doing work against friction is to take work and convert it into heat. That's the net result, and the whole thing is finished. If I go in a circle, I can bring the object back, and it's all done, and the net result was I did work, and there's heat in the reservoir. Can we reverse it? Turn the switch, the thing goes around backwards, does work against me, and the sea cools. Answer, according to Carnot, no. Let us suppose that that's impossible. If it were possible, it would mean, among other things, that we could convert heat from one temperature and carry it from, a cold body, take it out of a cold body and put it into a hot body. Now, you know it's natural that a hot thing can warm up a cool thing. But if you put a hot and cold thing together and nothing else changes, it isn't going to be that the hot one gets hotter and the cold one gets colder. And if we could do work, just plain work, by taking the heat out of an object like the ocean, say, or something at a given temperature, then that work could be used as by friction to be converted back into heat at some other temperature. That is, the other arm of the working machine could be rubbing something that's hot already. And so we would be taking heat from a cold body to a hot body. So it's often also stated that the hypothesis of Carnot, or sometimes called the second law of thermodynamics, is that heat of itself cannot flow from cold to hot. But as I just explained to you, those two principles are equivalent. One, that you can't get work out of a given temperature, and the other, that you can't make heat from it by itself in a cyclic process go from cold to hot, are of course equivalent, and I'll use the first form. Now, Carnot made an analysis of heat engines in the manner, and that is exactly similar to the argument that I gave about the conservation of energy in a very early lecture. In fact, that argument was patterned after Carnot's argument about heat engines, the weightlifting engines that we were talking about before, and so the argument will go very much the same. Suppose that we have a heat engine. A heat engine takes, there's a boiler somewhere, and a certain heat, Q1, goes into the boiler, and the temperature at which the heat has come out from the boiler is at T1. Then the machine does some work, that is, the steam engine does some work, and it goes and takes and delivers out into a condenser at another temperature, T2, some heat. Carnot didn't say how much heat because he didn't want to use the first law because he didn't know it. And he didn't want to use the law that Q2 was equal to Q1 either because he didn't believe it, although everybody thought that according to caloric, the heat would have to be the same. He didn't say it was the same, and that's the cleverness of the argument. But we can say what it is. The heat that's delivered here would be the heat that's put in minus the work that's done. Okay, we take Q1, we put it in, we do some work, and when the heat Q2 goes out, and we have some kind of a cyclic process where the water is pumped back into the boiler after it's condensed, and it keeps on going around. So for one cycle, say, of a certain amount of water going around, we have Q1 going in, Q2 coming out, and work W done. Now the idea is we're going to build another engine and see if we can't get more work from the same amount of heat being delivered into T1 and the discharge condenser being at temperature T2. Get more work. Of course, Q2 would be less, but that's not the point. Keep Q1 the same. Use the same amount of heat from the boiler and get more work than we do out of the steam engine, maybe by alcohol. So we have to analyze this. Now, in the case of the conservation of energy, we invented one thing is clear, that if when we're doing the work, there's a whole lot of devices in here in which there's lots of friction, we're not getting anywhere. We're losing something. So the best engine will be a frictionless engine. So we take the idealization, as we did in the case of the first law, that we have a practically frictionless engine. Now, there's another aspect of things which we have to have, which to get the idea, the analog of frictionless heat transfer. The heat, if I put a hot object with a high temperature against a cold object and the heat flows, then it's not possible to make that heat reverse by a very small force. You see, when we have a frictionless machine, practically, if we put a little force, it goes one way. If we put a little force the other way, it goes the other way. And we want the analog of a heat transfer where we can reverse the direction of the heat transfer with only a tiny change. If the difference in temperature is finite, that's impossible. But if you make sure that every time your heat is being transferred, it's transferred between two things at essentially the same temperature, with just an infinitesimal difference to make sure that it goes the way you want, an infinitesimal difference in temperature, then by heating, cooling is just a shade, then the heat will go this way. And if we make this just a little bit hotter, the heat will go the other way. So one idea is to kind of get the ideal engine, or the so-called reverse winner, which every process is reversible in the sense that by minor changes, infinitesimal changes, we can get the things to go the opposite direction. That means, for instance, that nowhere in the machine must there be any appreciable friction, and nowhere in the machine must there be any place where the heat of the reservoirs, or whatever they are, the boilers, the flames of the boiler and so on, is in direct contact with something definitely cooler, like the cool water running in here into the hot reservoir, is not a good idea. So we then consider the possibility that in an idealized case, we can have all the processes reversible. In order to illustrate that such a thing is possible, instead of giving it just abstractly, I'll illustrate an example of an engine which may or may not be practical, but which at least is reversible in the sense of Carnot's ideas. Suppose that we have a gas in a cylinder here, and that we have two heat pads, T1 and T2, reservoirs, great big things that have just got a certain definite temperature, T1 and T2. And so I'm going to suppose in this case that T1 is higher than T2. Now we take this gas and we start in a certain condition. And as the first thing that we do is to heat it up and let it expand. When we do this, we make sure that the temperature of the gas never gets very far away from T1. We pull the piston out very slowly as the heat comes in. If we pull it out, let it out too fast, the temperature of this will fall too much below T1, and then it won't be quite reversible. So if we let it out slowly enough, it'll never be much time for this temperature to get much away from T1, and that if we were to think that a minute we didn't like the idea and we wanted to go back the other way and push the piston back slowly, the temperature would just be a little bit higher than T1, but only infinitesimal, and the heat would pour back and the whole process is reversible. So this isothermal expansion done slowly and easily enough is a reversible process. Anyway, we start in a certain volume and let it expand isothermally to a certain amount. Incidentally, in order to follow what we're doing, I made a plot here to help you to see what's going on of the pressure against the volume. And I suppose this is some kind of gas in here. Not necessarily a perfect gas. Doesn't make any difference. In fact, it doesn't have to be a gas. The idea is the same, but let's say we have definitely a gas. And then what I've done is I've started at some point here. This plot tells me the pressure is a function of volume. Now, if I'm expanding, as the thing expands, the pressure falls. But this is a curve that tells me how the pressure and volume changes if the temperature is kept fixed. You know, for an ideal gas, that curve is PV equals RT. But this is an isothermal expansion, some kind of a curve of pressure falling as the volume increases until I get to some point here, which is the expanded condition, the end of step one. Step one is indicated here. While this is happening, a certain heat, Q1, has to be put in here in order to maintain the temperature. Because listen, if this thing weren't tied on to T1 and I let it expand, if there were no way for it to get up heat, it would cool off. You remember we discussed that as you expand the gas, it cools off. So it isn't cooling off. We're keeping the temperature fixed, so we've got to keep pouring heat in. Let's say the total heat that's put in there is Q1. That done, we take the thing away from the reservoir and continue the expansion. Keep on expanding, but this time with no heat coming in, so that the temperature, in fact, falls. Again, we do it slowly, adiabatically, so that there's no reason why we can't reverse it. And we forget about all kinds of frictions and so on. So as it continues to expand, the temperature falls. And I let this thing expand until, by luck, until the temperature has fallen to T2. So that's reversible also. And this is represented by the blue line on this curve. You know that the law here, for instance, for an ideal gas is PV to the gamma. is a constant, where gamma is greater than 1, which is a higher slope than the other curve. So it does look like this in general. Now we have the temperature, the thing at temperature T2. The can of gas now has gotten to temperature T2. And therefore, if I put it on the reservoir of temperature T2, there's nothing irreversible. If I can't put something whose temperature is T1 right close to T2, I got an irreversible quick heat flow. But I have it at T2, so it's just the same temperature. Put it on, nothing happened. Now I compress. And when I compress it, I do that isothermally again. And when I compress it isothermally, of course, if it wasn't isothermal and I just compressed it, the temperature would rise again. But this time it's against the reservoir. So instead of the temperature rising, heat flows into the reservoir at the temperature T2 or heat Q2. Okay, when I'm all done compressing it to a certain point, which is over here, this is another isothermal compression. I take it off of T2 and compress it still further, but this time without letting any heat flow out. And of course, the temperature will rise. And if I've got my cycle just right, I can make it rise back to T1. Well, I can compress until it's back to T1 and then put it back in this step one again and keep on going around the cycle. So that on this diagram, we've carried the stuff around a complete cycle of conditions. And in the result of one cycle, we put Q1 in at temperature T1 and remove Q2 at temperature T2. Now, the point is that this is a reversible cycle. That means that I could represent all the steps the other way around. I could have started with the thing, instead of going forwards, I go backwards. I take it here at temperature T1 in step 4. I expand it until it's T2. Put it on here. Expand it still further. Absorbing heat Q2. Then I get to that stage, and so on. I go around the cycle backwards. Of course, in doing it one way, I do work. It does work for me. I mean, it does work on me, and the other time I do work on it. The work is reversed. Incidentally, just for your interest, it's easy to find out what the total amount of work is, because the work during any expansion is the pressure times the change in volume, PdV. And on this particular diagram, I have plotted P vertically and V horizontally. So if I call the vertical distance y and the horizontal distance x, this is y dx. In other words, the area under the curve. So when there's anything, the area under the curve is the work done. So the area under this minus that is the net work done. And it's easy to see then that the net work done is the shaded area of the picture. Now, that proves that there are reversible, MEM doesn't prove, but argues that there are reversible machines. And we've given a single example. We'll suppose that there are such engines are possible. Now suppose that such engines are possible, reversible engines. Then I consider I have an engine A, a reversible engine A, which takes Q1 at T1 and does work W and distributes, and it delivers the heat, delivers heat at T2. That's what we started with, but it's reversible. Now I have any other engine made by man, designed or otherwise, made out of rubber bands, steam, or whatever, another engine, reversible or not, I don't care, which is designed so that it takes the heat Q1 at T1, and it's so built that it works between the high temperature T1 and the low temperature T2, and of course it'll do some work, otherwise it's not a good engine. Does some work W prime. Now I want to argue that W prime is not greater than W. No engine can do more work than a reversible one. Why? Well, suppose that this W prime were bigger than W. Then I take the heat Q1 out of this reservoir T1. And with engine B, I do work W prime, and I deliver some heat to T2. I don't care how much. That done, I take of this W prime, which is supposed to be greater than W, the part of it W, the remainder, W prime minus W, I save for useful work. I mean, I keep that. I can do things with that. But I take a part of it W, and I run this machine A, the reversible machine, backwards as a refrigerator. The reversible machine backwards so that I take some heat from Q2 and deliver Q1 back to T1. So in one cycle, it was a double cycle, I let the machine B go forwards and take away Q1, then machine A puts it back. So that the reservoir T1 doesn't have to be very big. After I take Q1 out, I just dump it back, I put it out, I dump it back, and so forth. So as in one complete cycle of both machines, what's the result? No heat has been taken from T1, nothing happened there. Some heat may be taken from T2, that's true. But the T1, nothing has happened. And the net result is I got some excess work. So I have therefore converted some heat from T2 into work, which is against the rules according to the way we started, because the net result of this double cycle would only be to take energy out of T2 and to do work. T1 is not important. It's a small reservoir that you dump in and take out. It's a temporary thing. After one cycle, it's back where it was before. And the net result is we brought everything back to where it was before, and we've done some excess work, namely W prime minus W, and all we did was take the energy out of the reservoir T2 against the rules. Can't be done. Therefore, no engine is more effective for a given amount of heat that takes out of the hot boiler and delivering at the same condenser temperature, T2, no engine can do more work than the reversible engine. Now suppose that B is also reversible. Then of course, not only must W prime be not greater than W, but in the backwards argument reversed, we can argue that W can't be bigger than W prime. Not naturally, because if they're both reversible, you can make the argument backwards. So if they're both reversible, they both do the same amount of work. And so we come to a brilliant idea of Carnot. That is, if an engine is reversible, it doesn't make any difference how it's designed. The amount of work you'll get out when you take a heat Q1 to T1 and deliver it at some other temperature, T2, does not depend on the design of the engine. It depends only, it's a property of the world. It's not a property of a particular engine. If we could find out what the law was, which determines how much work we do get out when we take Q1 or T1, this quantity would be a universal thing independent of the substance. Of course, we could, if we knew the properties of a particular substance, work it out. We could work it out for a particular substance and then say every other substance must give the same amount of work in a reversible engine. And that's the key idea. That's the clue by which we're going to find the relationship between how much, for instance, the rubber band contracts when you heat it and how much it cools when you contract it. Because we imagine put that rubber band in a reversible machine where we heat it and it contracts and we cool it, the same thing with the gas, it's the same thing. Go around a cycle and say that the net result is that the total amount of work done is the universal function, that great function, which is independent of the substance. And so you see substances' properties must be limited in a certain way. You can't make up anything you want, or you'll be able to invent a substance which, when you carry it around the cycle, would violate this maximum work that you can get out. So that is the limitation. That's the principle of thermodynamics, and that's really the only real rule that comes out of the thermodynamics. Now I'd like to try to find the law which determines the W as a function of Q1, T1, and T2. I think it's pretty clear that W is proportional to Q1. If you don't like that, prove it. Consider two engines in parallel, both working together, both double engine. That's a reversible engine, that combination. If each one took Q1, the two of them together takes 2Q1, and the work done is 2W, and so on. So there's a new engine, a double engine, which takes 2Q1 and gives 2W, and so on. So it's not unreasonable. W is proportional to Q1. Now, the next important idea is to consider, to discover this universal law by a logical argument rather than by experiment, is the following. We know the following. Suppose that we have three temperatures. We have two engines with three temperatures. We have a temperature T1, and let's say another temperature T3, and another temperature T2. Now what I'm going to do is to make an engine which takes away heat Q1 from the temperature T1 and does a certain amount of work W1-3, or whatever you want to call it, just to remind yourself of what temperatures it's running between, and delivers a heat Q3 to the temperature T3. That's the same as the other one, except I use T3 instead of T2. But now I would like to have another engine which runs between T2 and T1. And suppose that I hooked this engine up of such a size that it would have taken heat Q2 and delivered Q3, the same Q3, just for fun. Actually, I'll run that machine backwards. So I'll suppose it takes a Q3 and delivers Q2. In the meantime, I have to put a certain amount of work into it. Actually, it's negative in this case because it's going the other way around, which I'll call W12. Now, the idea is the following, that this machine, when this machine goes through a cycle, it takes heat out Q1 and delivers it to Q3. Then the other machine takes the Q3 out of the reservoir Q3 and delivers it into Q2. And therefore, the net result of the two machines in tandem is to take the energy Q1 from the heat Q1 from T1 and deliver Q2 at T2. What we're trying to do is to get the laws which relate the efficiencies of the engines. And you see there's some kind of a relationship between the efficiency of an engine running between 1 and 3 and between 2 and 3 and between 1 and 2. Now, I make that argument very clear in the following way. Please, we can obviously, therefore, always relate the Q1 T1 with the Q2 T2 by letting it go through some other intermediate. And therefore, we can get all the engine's properties if we'll use a standard temperature down here and analyze everything with a certain standard temperature. In other words, if we knew the efficiency for running between a certain temperature T and a certain arbitrary standard, then we could work it out for any other difference in temperature because we consider that we don't have to go directly here. We go down to the standard and back up again. For the standard temperature, I will use what we'll define as 1 degree, just some special arbitrary temperature, which is defined as 1 degree. So if you'll permit me, let me call the temperature of the standard that I'm going to use 1 degree. And to be very definite that a special case of one special temperature, the heat which is delivered in a case like this, I will call S. In other words, when an engine runs with heat Q at temperature T, will deliver at temperature 1 a heat S. If one of them, taking Q1 and T1, will deliver S at temperature 1, and if Q2 at T2 will deliver the same S, if they both correspond to the same S, then it will be true that Q1 at the temperature T1 will deliver Q2 if it ran between T1 and T2 because of this argument here. So all we really have to do is find out how much heat is required to be put in at temperature T1 in order to deliver a certain amount of heat S at temperature 1. That's the thing we have to discover. We got that. We got the whole thing. We got this. Q is, of course, a function of T. The higher the temperature, the more the Q. That's easy to see if you think a minute or two, that the higher the temperature, the more the Q, because going from here to here, we have to do some work so that this Q must be bigger than that Q. The higher the temperature, the larger the Q. And so the thing is the great law somehow that Q, for a given amount of S is the heat delivered at 1 degree from an engine running between temperature T and 1 degree, is S times some function of the temperature, which is always rising. At this stage, we're not going to ever find the formula for the function of the temperature, but we're going to define temperature by a new scale. Up until this time, the temperature was defined arbitrarily by saying you divide the expansion of water in certain even degrees. And when they measured it with mercury, it wasn't even degrees anymore. And here is a definition of temperature which is independent of the substance, because this function doesn't depend upon what device we use, because the efficiency of these engines, reversible engines, is independent of it. And since it rises with temperature, we will define this as the temperature. So that is the measure of the scale of temperature. You can tell how hot the object is by finding out how much heat it takes out when it's delivered at the unit temperature. If that heat is 7 times as much as delivered at the condenser, if the 7 times as much heat is taken out of the boiler as is delivered at a 1 degree condenser, the temperature will be called 7 degrees, and so forth. So by measuring how much heat comes out for different kinds of temperatures, we determine the temperature. This is a definition of temperature called the absolute thermodynamic temperature, independent of the substance. So that defines the temperature. Incidentally, this S has a definite name, too. It's called the entropy. It's a measure of the effectiveness of heat. It's a measure of how good this heat is, so to speak. We can measure heat in so and so many joules. But for the purposes of analyzing engines, it's interesting to know that this heat would be equivalent to the delivery of so and so much heat at 1 degree in its equivalence. And that heats at different temperatures have different degrees of equivalent given by this. Now we can see from this argument here that when the two engines are working right, Q1 equal T1 is S is the same as Q2 equal T2. In other words, if we have an engine running between T1 and T2, then the result of the whole thing, the grand finale of this talk, is that Q1 is to T1 is as Q2 is to T2 when there's a reversible engine which takes energy Q1 at T1 and delivers a heat Q2 at T2. If it's reversible, there must be this relationship among the heats. That's the whole thing. That's all there is to it. That's the center of the universe of thermodynamics. Now we start to make deductions, just like after you get F equals ma, the center of the universe of mechanics. Then it goes on and on and on after that. In the same way, that's all there is to it. But boy, can you make conclusions out of this. And we begin to make conclusions. First conclusion, combining the both laws, the law of the conservation of energy and this law which determines what Q2 is in terms of Q1, we can easily obtain the efficiency of the engine. How much work do we do? It's Q1 minus Q2. According to this, Q2 is T2 over T1 Q1. So this is Q1 times 1 minus T2 over T1. Or, as some people like to write the same thing to remember it, T1 minus T2 over T1. It's not written very well. That tells us the efficiency of the engine. How much work we get out of how much heat. The efficiency of an engine is proportional to the difference in temperatures over absolute temperatures over which you're able to run the engine, divided by the temperature of the highest one. The efficiency cannot be greater than 1, and the absolute temperature cannot be less than 0. There's absolute 0. So that since T2 must be positive, the efficiency is always less than 1. I said the same thing just a moment ago in reverse. That's one conclusion. The next conclusion that one can draw, or you can put all these equations together in 1,000 ways. But unfortunately, we are not going to enter into the field of thermodynamics very far. My purpose is only to illustrate the ideas of the arguments and the reason why it's possible to make such arguments. But we'll not use our thermodynamics very much in this course. The thermodynamics is used very much by engineers and particularly by chemists. And so we will let you learn the thermodynamics in practice in the chemistry or engineering. But I think it's not worthwhile duplicating everything. We'll just give some discussion of the origin of the theory rather than much detail for special applications. I would like to show you one other interesting consequence of this, and that is the following. In doing a problem like the substance here, the substance at any moment can be the condition of it, can be described by telling what its temperature is and what its volume is. And if you know the temperature and volume of the substance, you know the pressure, which is some function of the temperature and volume. And you know the internal energy, which is presumably it has some internal energy, which is a function of temperature and volume, has some pressure, function of temperature and volume. Or you could say, I don't want to do it that way. If you tell me the temperature and the pressure, I'll tell you the volume, and I can think of the volume as a function of temperature and pressure, the internal energy as a function of temperature and pressure, and so on. That's why thermodynamics is hard, because everybody uses a different way of doing. And if you'd only sit down one and stick to it, it would be fairly easy. If we'd stick to a certain pair of variables, and the chemists always stick to temperature and pressure, and therefore you'd think it would be nice of me to do this thing with those variables. But just for the hell of it, I'm going to use temperature and volume. Now, it's interesting that beside the pressure, which is a property of the temperature and the volume, and the internal energy, which is a property of temperature and volume, there's another quantity now which can be called a property of the condition, which we call the entropy of the object. You see, we have a gas.
which has a certain volume and a certain temperature, and so it has a certain pressure, has certain internal energy, has a new property, which I'll call the entropy of it. And let me try to explain how I get that and what it means. Consider the object in two different conditions, much as we had in this experiment here where we did the adiabatic isothermal expansion and so on. Incidentally, there's no need that the heat engine have only two reservoirs. It could have three or four different temperatures at which you take and deliver heats and so on. So that we can move around on a PV diagram all over the place and go from one condition to another. In other words, we could say the gas is in a certain condition A, and then it goes over to some other condition B. And we will suppose that this transition made from A to B is made in every step reversibly. If you wanted to expand, you do it at a certain temperature with reservoirs and all this other stuff. It must be a reversible transformation from one to the other. Now, all through here, we'd have to have a whole lot of little reservoirs at different temperatures. If heat comes out at a certain temperature, if dQ comes out, happens to come out at temperature T, and so on. Then I say this, let's take all these reservoirs and connect them by reversible heat engines to a single reservoir at temperature 1. So then when I'm done with carrying the thing from A to B, all the reservoirs are brought back to their original condition. Any heat that's come out of this object has been converted by a machine, reversible machine, down here. And there's a certain amount of entropy been delivered, the heat at temperature 1, I mean. That's what I mean by entropy. So there's a certain amount of entropy been delivered from all of these in going from A to B. And let's say that the total amount of entropy which has been delivered to all of these, I'm sorry, I got the sign wrong. Let's say that we have to put heat in. Well, then we could get it from temperature 1 by a heat engine running the other way. So let dS be the amount of heat taken out at temperature T1 and then put, of course the heat isn't put, but let's dS be the amount that has to be taken out at temperature 1 in order to run this thing from A to B. Then what we say is that the entropy difference, that there's an entropy for each, the entropy needed to go from A to B by this particular reversible cycle is the total entropy, the total heats that are taken out of reservoir temperature 1. Now, the question is, does that depend upon the motion? In other words, if I took it along another reversible cycle, what? There's more than one reversible way to go from A to B? Sure there is. Look, in here I can go from here, from this point to this point, by first expanding isothermally and then adiabatically, or I could first expand adiabatically and then isothermally. I can go more than one way. So the question is next, whether the entropy needed to go from A to B is the same on one route as it is on another. It must be the same, because if I carried it all the way around the cycle, I would have a reversible engine, and I would have no loss of heat. There would be no change. You see, just like in this engine here, Q1 over T1 was the entropy taken from the bottom reservoir, and Q2 over T2 was the entropy delivered. I mean, one was delivered and the other was taken out, so that the net result is zero. And in a reverse, total reversible cycle, no heat must be taken from the reservoir temperature 1. So the entropy needed to go to A and B is the same over this path as it is over that path. It is independent of path and depends only on the end point. And so we can say that there's a certain function which we call the entropy of the object that depends on the condition. If you tell me T and V, I'll give you an S of T and V which has the following property. That if you calculate it for two different conditions, and then figure out how when you carry the thing along by a reversible process and you converted all the heats down into temperature 1, you'd find that the total heat that was taken out of the reservoir at temperature 1, that is the total entropy change, is the difference between the S calculated at one temperature and volume and the S calculated at another. Now this definition needed here doesn't define the entropy. It defines the difference of entropy for two different conditions. And only if I can give you the entropy for one special condition can you really define absolutely this S. For a long time, it was believed that absolute entropy didn't mean anything. But finally, Nernst made what he called Nernst's heat theorem, which is also called the third law of thermodynamics. And it's very simple, but I won't explain it here. And that, I mean, I'll tell you what it is, but I won't explain why it's true. And that is that the entropy of any object at absolute zero is zero. So we know one case of T and V, namely T equals zero, where S is zero, and then we can get the entropy at any other temperature. So that's one of the consequences, that there's a new property of states. Now I'd like to remark on some of the properties of the entropy of things. We first note that if we go on a reversible cycle from A to B, then the entropy of the object will change by SA minus SB. But at the same time, we have the reservoir down here, which has lost a certain heat, which is the same amount. If, let's suppose that we say this, that if a reservoir at temperature T loses a heat Q somewhere, then the change in entropy, or the loss of entropy, if it loses Q, then the loss of entropy of the reservoir is Q over T, because if this heat is converted into temperature 1, it's equivalent to Q over T. Now I would like to show first, we know already, that if we have a reversible cycle, the total entropy of everything is not changed. And that's this rule here, because when Q was put in at temperature T1 and taken out at temperature T2, this was a gain in entropy, and this was a loss in entropy, and a net change in entropy is zero. So for reversible cycles, there's no change in the entropy of everything, reservoirs included. Not even a cycle. In a reversible process, if we add the entropies that have taken out of reservoirs and put into materials and so on and add it all together, there's no change. So it looks like the conservation of energy again. But it isn't true. It is no law of conservation of entropy, because I give two examples. First, suppose that I do work on an object. I do work by friction. That's irreversible. I do work, and I generate a heat Q on some object of temperature T. So the entropy is increased by Q over T. So when I do Q is the work, and so when I do a certain amount of work and friction against an object whose temperature is T, the entropy of the whole world increases by W over T. Another example. Another example of irreversibility is if I put two things together touching each other that are a finite difference in temperature, say T1 and T2, and a certain amount of heat flows from one to the other by itself, nobody doing any work, no reversible energy, a complete loss. Just put a hot stone in cold water. Then a certain heat Q goes from T1 to T2. How much does the entropy of the stone change, the hot stone? It changes by loss, Q1 over T1. How much does the water entropy change? It changes by gain, Q over T2. It'll only go from hot to cold if T1 is greater than T2. So this, if Q is positive, T1 is greater than T2. So the change in entropy of the whole world is the difference of these two fractions. But this has a larger denominator than this, and therefore it's greater than zero. So the proposition is the following, and it's true. In any process that's irreversible, the entropy of the whole world increased. For processes that are reversible, is the only case where it doesn't increase. Of course, no process is absolutely reversible. There's always a little loss. So there's always a gain in the entropy. In a reversible process, an idealization in which we've made it minimal, the loss, the gain of the entropy of the universe when we went through the process. And so the two laws of thermodynamics are often stated this way. First law, the energy of the universe is always constant. Second law, the entropy of the universe is always increasing. That's not a very good statement of the second law, because it doesn't say, for example, that in a reversible cycle, the entropy stays the same. It doesn't say exactly what the entropy is. It's just a clever way of remembering the two laws, but it doesn't really tell you exactly what they are. Next time, I will apply these laws to discover the relationship between the heat generated in the expansion of the rubber band and the extra tension when you heat it up. Thank you. I give you the, you can have the thermodynamic. It's a very difficult subject. Yeah, it is. I find that when I want to derive a relationship, like between the expansion of the rubber band and the other one, when I start out straightforwardly, I say, well, let's see, one of them is how much the temperature changes when I change the tension of the other. And then I got to fish and fish and fish to find a relation. It's not, I don't know an organized way of plowing along and getting out the relation that I want.
Well, I think this is the beauty of the Gibbs approach.
It's straightforward way, is it?
It's more straightforward.
Uh-huh.
But the worst part here is, it's almost impossible to appreciate the fish.
The difficulties.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, already there's this, one quickly gets feeling the entropy is abstract and it's a property of the substance and it's all kind of, it's a hard subject. Yeah, well, I'll let you teach it to them.
Did you know a forebear of mine discovered this thing?
No, I didn't
know
that.
I'll tell you a note about it. The guy who taught John Dalton found this expected temperature on rubber bands back about 1800.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'll send you a little note that was published here by a fellow from Dartmouth recently. And he discovered it because he was blind. Very interesting story.
Oh, you mean he felt the...
He was using his tongue and lips for sensing temperatures and identifying plants and things like this. And so he had a rubber band.
And was playing with it.
Who is it? John Dalton.
Can you feel it? Is it possible? Have a rubber band. Try it out. Yes, not very large, but it's there. Yeah, you have to wait for it to cool off, of course, after you've expanded it, so before you can... Yeah, it does it? Hold it out, see, stretch it, and wait for it to cool to the normal room temperature. It's all right now. Yeah, it's definite when it's done that way.
Nice, you give us the theory and then you try it out.
Yeah.
Did you find it?
Yeah.
You said you can't extract word from a system where everything's at one temperature?
Yes. And leave it back the way it was before.
Oh.
I told you the example of the compressed air, where after it's all expanded, of course you've done work, but the air is expanded. We want to bring everything back. You see, there's an only here. A process whose net result is only to take heat from a reservoir and convert it to work is impossible. So a compressed air, when it expands, it's changed from compressed air to expanded air. You can't do it again. So that you can do. But if you have a process, if you wanted to get the air back into the can and had to pump it back in and so on, you'd find you'd do more work and lose, and you wouldn't get work out in the net result.
Does this mean that you can't take a hot object all by itself and make it into a cold object and take the heat away?
Exactly. That's precisely what it means.
Suppose you had a gas in a closed container,
right,
and a microphone, and ran
right
it through a rectifier, and
right
got DC out.
It won't work.
Why won't it?
Well, we'll have to talk about that. It's a good example. See, there's a whole lot of inventions of this kind, none of which work. It turns out that rectifiers don't rectify when the voltages are so very tiny. You remember that a resistor had a noise in it.
Right.
Well, it turns out a rectifier has a noise in it, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it doesn't really work. The molecular noise from the resistors here going through the rectifier, it makes more noise, too. It doesn't run at such a low value. If you cool the rectifier so that it's perfect, then it would work. It would work. But then you have a difference in temperature. See, you have a difference in temperature. Then it works. If you have this cool and that one warm, you can get a voltage out the other end and get work out of it. But it's only working because there's a difference in temperature. By the time the rectifier heats up to the same temperature as the noise of the resistor, it doesn't rectify anymore. It just makes jiggling.
You said that for a resistor, the total energy in the noise is the same, one half T kT, was it?
Well, per unit frequency range, it was 1/2 kT. Yes, it depends.
And you if said. You had a high resistor, you'd get more voltage but less current?
That's right.
So could we make a very low resistance rectifier and a very high resistance?
No,
resistance?
I think if you think it out, it won't, no.
One nice thing about this whole thing is that you may not be able to see quite but you can be damn sure it won't.
It just doesn't, and it turns out that it's the best way to do thermodynamics is really to analyze such a thing. If you want to understand the properties of a rectifier at very low voltages and what the noises are in rectifiers, the best way to do it is to start out with a device like this, to argue that it's impossible, to deduce what the rectifier has to be like in order that this damn thing doesn't work, and that's the way rectifiers will turn out to be. And that's the whole idea of the whole thing. That any gadget that you can cook up isn't going to work, and that'll tell you something about the gadget. And so in the same way with a rubber band, they cook up a gadget to make perpetual motion, say, of this kind, where you take energy out of a finite temperature and deliver it work without doing anything else. It doesn't work, and when you figure out what that means, it tells you a relationship between how much it's got to cool when you let it off the pressure and how much it pulls when you heat it up.
Suppose you had a box with perfect mirror sides on them and you have a gas at high temperature and you put a photocell in it, and you get infrared radiation from the molecules.
Yes, right.
Can't you have the infrared?
Yes, yes. But the photocell, if it's warm, will also emit infrared. You see, an object, it won't work when the photocell in order to work has to be cold. If it's warm, it also emits as much as it absorbs. So you'll find that the power coming to the photocell is balanced. If you take an ordinary bolometer or a very accurate infrared detector and shine it, say, and have it room temperature, and in a room of the same temperature, it picks up as much heat from the walls as it happens to radiate. Mm-hmm. If you shine it on a warm object that walks in like a person, it goes up in power. If you turn it, because more is coming to it then, but if you turn it to the sky, it gives an absorption. It does the opposite. It doesn't deliver power to the amplifier. It delivers minus power to the amplifier. It takes power out. And you can obtain that signal too. So you can detect cold with the thing, but by a backward signal. Mm-hmm. But when it's at the same temperature, it's even because it's radiating as much as it's picking up. And this is, of course, an extremely powerful argument. You keep using it all the time to discover what the radiation properties of a object must be, for instance. Suppose you have something which reflects very much. It doesn't absorb much heat from, you know what I mean? If the heat, if black, one thing is black, everything it hits it absorbs. Another thing is light gray. The light comes in, but it mostly bounces away. Only a little bit is absorbed. Now, suppose we have this in a furnace at temperature T. Two of them, we compare. Just to show you how the idea works, you see. Here's a big furnace. Everything's at temperature T, white hot. Then I put in a black patch here and a gray patch here, light gray or white almost, but not perfect, just to make sure. And these are both at temperature T after a while. I mean, they get into equilibrium. Now, we know under those circumstances that there must be no gaining or losing of energy, or otherwise this will get hot, we'll be able to run an engine and all this kind of nonsense. So against the second law that this should get hot, hotter than the temperature of the walls. Now this, every time a light hits it, it absorbs. This, when the light hits it, most of the time it's reflected, it only absorbs a little bit. Therefore, at the same temperature T, the gray was going to emit only a little bit, while the black has to emit more in exactly the same proportion as its light gray compared to black. You know, that is, the emission rates at a given temperature are as proportional to the absorption. So if you will take a glass, a piece of porcelain or some rough white stuff that you can heat up without it burning, like something white, like porcelain, and make a pencil, a broken edge of a piece of porcelain is the easiest to get a hold of. Make pencil marks on it and then heat it in a flame. So it's red hot with the lights out so you can see. Then you'll notice that the black part is much brighter than the wall, than the rest, because of this thing, that the black emits well when it's hot and the white doesn't, in the same reverse of the other. Because otherwise one would heat up and the other would cool off.
That's right, yes. If you shine the light of the furnace on it, there'd be more reflection from this one.
Yeah.
So you'll see that by reflection, and you'd see this one by emission, and they would look exactly the same.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Okay. Oh, their microphone.